Any questions before I try to? Yeah.
I have a question.
Yeah. You've noticed there's a psychoanalytic subtext. We're working on the theory of castration, right?
Always.
I feel very self-conscious.
Wait.
Go ahead. It's actually a political question, not a psychoanalytic question. And it has to do with the listing Kristeva in that group, which I think is somehow appropriate. But my question is something like Telkel and Kristeva should be understood within a dialectical structure? Because there seems to be a certain kind of speculative identity between the most radical form of politics, which is that moment of the French Maoists, and typical consumer liberal society, which both posit the same context as the political context, which is an individual internal revolution, which ultimately has no radical effect on any kind of struggle. So given that there is a certain kind of speculative identity between those two, can we not say that this is within a dialectical structure and also have a sort of grounds for critiquing it?
I think that's just what I've been trying to do. I mean, that's just, I thought that was the claim I was just trying to make, that it's not an accident for me. I mean, when I, of course, Hegel is thinking about Schlegel a lot, but it's worth reminding ourselves that this Schlegel, the one that I'm claiming here is the Schlegel of Derridean post-structuralist thought. It's the book on the novel by Lacoue Labarthe and Nancy. It's around that, and exactly its claim, so we ought to be clear here, the claim of this stuff is exactly that it's not dialectical. It's outside of a dialectical history. And therefore, Hegel sees that before there was even dialectic. Right? He understands perfectly that this is meant to be a anti-dialectical strategy.
Can I ask the unfair follow-up question?
Sure.
Then what would it look like to move from intimate revolt to any kind of affirmative political department whatsoever?
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
That's what we're here collectively doing. And I'll try to do something more with it next year when I talk about the course on torture. Trying to carry on this argument. I wish I had a neat answer, but you ought to hear in your question the same as Paul's question, right? Because Paul is asking a version of how can this claim have motivational significance? That is, how is it inheritable? Because if it's tragedy but it's not effective, then it's not inheritable. So that it looks like a way in which Hegel is both claiming a necessity for a certain type of tragic narration and simultaneously its non-inheritability. Right? And that's why I said at certain moments what he'll do is point elsewhere and say, well, they'll have to do the motivational work. Right? Let religion do the motivational work. And I'll tell you why it's okay to be a Lutheran. Because God is dead. So there's a problem here. And Hegel doesn't have an answer to it. And that's what will make his thought always about the French Revolution even for him, sometimes appear conservative. That nugget is the problem in Hegel after the phenomenology, the very question you've asked of inheritability. Okay. So Hegel says in paragraph 593, absolute freedom is pure self-identity of the universal will, thus has within it negation. But this means it contains difference in general, and this again, it develops as an actual difference. I mean, talk about a sloppy transition. It's just, but this is your problem in a nutshell. It's kind of wishful thinking. He says, well, look, if it contains negation, negation means difference, then difference had better be, if it's going to be anything, actual difference. Ba-boom! So we can start again. So there's a problem here of inheritability. The general strategy Hegel wants is to have spirit take on its nothingness, its groundlessness, its negativity as its own. Right? That's the reflective move. That terra forces it into reflexivity. That's what he's claiming. That to be, we need to be terrified by terra. That's the movement into reflection. And that's what makes it possible for us to begin thinking about how we might assume responsibility for that nothingness, which, and this is why I was pointing to this, the best way to say that is he's saying that we must symbolically assume the castration, that's another way of reading the terra, right, that had both been inflicted and suffered. And that this is a traumatic recognition that translates or determines immediacy as mediate. So it's a determinism. That's another way of just relocating the moment in history, right? See the immediacy as mediated out of the moment of necessary reflexivity that comes from the terror. So that radical loss, he wants to say, must congeal, if there's any hope at all, into an ultimate acquisition of a subject whose ultimate heroism is, and he's going to say this in a variety of ways, is to gain self-possession through self-dispossession. That's going to be the strategy. That we cannot, think about it another way. Look, if we have a will to presence and that keeps failing, if we keep trying to gather everything in and make ourselves self-sufficient, self-determining, and that ain't going to work, then let's do the opposite. We can only possess ourselves by emptying ourselves out. That's what he thinks the incarnation is. God emptying himself out. Self-dispossessing himself of what? Being God. Right? That's what the incarnation is. The most radical act of self-dispossession. So what we have to figure is strategies of self-dispossession. That's what we're going to read about in Evil and Forgiveness. We're going to have to dispossess ourselves as the condition of self-possession. And it's not an accident, I think, that that's exactly what Adorno says in Negative Dialectics all over the place. Literally that phrase. Okay. So, pure negation contains difference in general, it must develop into actual difference. There therefore must be an acknowledgement of difference. But there also occurs a denial of its actuality. So we need to return to culture under a new description. And the culture we need to return to under the new description is through, again, a recognition of the fear of death. So think of the fear of death as a tragic self-understanding now, a political self-understanding of the impossibility of absolute self-possession. The easiest way to think of this politically, if you want a political analogy here, is through Bataille and Lefort. Bataille talks about the idea of a headless community. And what Bataille means by the idea of a headless community is that we need to behead the king. Not just once, but over and over and over again. And he calls that act of beheading the king democracy. And he calls it, or so it's the idea of a non-sovereign people. Non-sovereign because it does not have a head, a king, a center. It is not gathered around the absolute state. So the idea, and what makes Bataille interesting here, I once wrote this up, but I never published it. But he wants to claim the act of the endless beheading, which he thinks is the practice of democracy, is the source of the social bond. So we are bonded together through the persistent beheading of sovereign authority. That is democratic practice. And the reason why this is Lefort's theory of democracy is, right, his theory of democracy is that democracy must have an empty center. And the responsibility of democracy is to keep that center empty, right? Which is very hard. Think about our problem with Bush, right? Would that democracy had... But no, we cannot behead the king. It turns out to be remarkably difficult, right? He says, we say something, he says, I veto it. I veto it. Well, no, I mean, you have to... I mean, that, you know, we say, let there be peace, I veto it. It's an act of sovereignty. The fact that he has, what, over 500 signing statements that say, what you call law, I call nothing? That's what Bush is doing. So Bush is literally making the state sovereign again. So at least one way of trying to think about... So, but the question is exactly how we inherit that nothingness at the center. Take it on. Hegel, if you think of the way in which... Let's say I'm never going on to morality. If you think of what he does at the end of the philosophy of right, he's very upset that he keeps having a sovereign. But what does he say that the king's job is? Even less than a mouthpiece. What does he do?
He signs.
He dots the I. It's got to be the sovereign center has to be literally non-sovereign, or the negativity is gone. Right. So he both has to have the moment of sovereignty and its emptiness. That's what Hegel is trying to think of in his theory of the monarch. Both the necessity of the sovereign and its emptiness. You need both, he thinks, because he thinks only that the dual structure will allow us to take on the full weight of responsibility for that idea in a theory of, right, of of a Republican state without democracy. That's not the democratic theory. He couldn't.
No German philosopher has ever thought democracy. Just beyond that, right? Well, because
it's really not a big mystery. They can. They think that democracy is the dictatorship of the majority. They think of it as a theory of sovereignty. And therefore, they think of it as tyrannical.
They do not have whatever we think democracy is. They don't.
So they had, no one had the thought of what Chantal Mouffe tomorrow is going to call an agonistic theory.
God help us. But anyway.
Does that help a little bit with
some political thought? Okay. So we have to take on this nothingness. So he says, again, paragraph 593, these individuals who have felt the fear of death of their absolute master again submit to negation and distinctions, arrange themselves as if by magic into the various spheres, and return to an apportioned and limited task, but thereby to their substantial reality. Back to Zitlakite. So what we can't get beyond Zitlakite, except we need a different relationship to it, because we know in its Greek form it's dumb. But we have to have some notion of Zitlakite if we're going to get anywhere. And that's to say that, and how things have changed from the moment we started, culture now includes within itself a moment of absolute negativity. That's what the Greeks didn't have. And further, what he says was missing, the passage I already read, is some notion of reciprocal action, which is to say, finding not just some externality, but some way of relating to the other that is neither reifying or death-dealing. That is either pure negation or pure realism. So all along, we've been trying to find a space, I can now reiterate the problem, of what is between skepticism and realism. And to find that turns out to be remarkably difficult, given what we are expected, given who we are. Namely, that we are free and self-determining. That's the moment, for example, that, say, John McDowell would not recognize. Second nature won't do it. You know, the life world won't, you know, that those kind of terms won't do it because they're denying the weight of modernity. So Hegel wants to figure out how this is going to occur within a weighty conception of modernity. So culture, when it reappears, is going to reappear in the form of a world that has become the dialectical opposite of the absolute will. Well, not the dialectical opposite. Is going to become the recognition by that will that it must mediate itself or fail. That my own negativity, my own consort for negativity is Willkür, that's the spontaneity of the will, and what it must do is mediate itself. So Kant's going to say that Wille is the rational essence. Of Willkür, where Willkür is the spontaneous or actual will, the power of negativity.
So vila is the rational essence, that's the moral law, of vilkur, and vilkur is the real essence of vila,
which is to say now freedom is self-mediating. So that's the way in which there's a break in this power of negativity itself, and that negativity now has to take that universality into itself as its own mediating principle of activity. It just can't directly will the universal, it has to will it reflect.
That's how we get to Kant.
So, German idealism. So, I mean, and let me say, get far today. So that Kant's formalism is going to be two-sided. It's both going to be terroristic. Here's the rational essence. And roughly Kant's argument is nothing is going to be valid or rational or virtuous or good unless it corresponds to the moral law. That's its terrorism. That is, there's an authority of the universality that denatures us. And remember, Kant's project is to denature us. That we should overcome our given natures, our natural selves, our pathological desires, and will only in accordance with pure reason. That, I'm claiming, is terrorism. But Kant's formalism, and it's the formalism that, as it were, it's Kant's formalism that stops Kant from being merely the French Revolution. His formalism makes it the French Revolution in thought, right? But that formalism also means something else. Namely, that principle of freedom, the moral law, always gets its content from elsewhere. So now we have a version of the problem of universal in particular that's internal to the very structure of subjectivity itself. And if there's any hope of figuring out how this is going to get them together, then we're going to do it because we have now mediated in the innermost structure of our subjectivity. Both particularity and universality as mutually dependent on one another. Vilkur is the moment of particularity, vila is the moment of universality, and working out the antinomies of Kant's moral thought then becomes the way in which we, as free and rational self-determining beings, begin the work of trying to inherit the French Revolution. So, German idealism then carries on the French Revolution in thought, is something like the claim, and Hegel is making the claim, that the meaning of the revolution is historically irreversible. This is why I will defend to the death the theory of progress. I'll go through all that again. I was thinking Martin Amis has a piece in The Guardian a couple of days ago that says something like, the only thing we moderns have to say about religion is that it is an implausible and regressive idea, and not one that any person living in the modern world can rationally accept even for a moment. And I like his intolerance. It seems to me that Moultrie culturalism begot a form of tolerance
that is self-denying in, to me, an incomprehensible way. As if the French Revolution were reversible. So the revolution, in the way it gets articulated in German idealism, brings us to, and this is what Hegel believed, a new form of human life in which human freedom is inextricable. That's why it's irreversible. So the two revolutions were of the same spirit, right? That's the claim of the Schlegel quote. And in addition to similar aims and purposes, there were indeed actual and deep connections. You know, Fichte saw funding from the revolutionary government for the Wissenschaftler. He just thought it was obvious. I love Fichte. Both the French Revolution and German idealism share certain fundamental philosophical presuppositions. And the commonalities are necessary for explaining the correlation. And part of it is of course, that, and this is the Lutheran moment, that changes in modes of consciousness must precede the reorganization of a political system. That hearts and minds are a condition for a new form of life, and you cannot have a real change in a socio-political system without a change in your self-description. And that change in your self-description will project a moral image of the world that would be adequate to the transformed self-description. Which is back to the introduction of the book. We are back in a time of birth. Hegel really does believe this is a birth moment, not a this end of history. Hegel is, always forgets. He thinks this is the real birth moment that he is marking here. So the section on morality, do I want to do this? I think it would be crazy to start it. So let me just tell you how to read it. The section on morality begins with an account of Kant on the postulates of pure practical reason. Why the postulates? Because in the postulates, Kant works out the consequences of his duality between freedom and nature. That the postulates are Kantian, so we say, oh, you don't need the postulates. Hegel thinks everything that's deep and important about Kant, you need the postulates. And you need the postulates, I mean, you know, it's all that stuff about the immortality of the soul, the existence of God. I'll explain it all next week. But the reason why Hegel thinks it's important is he thinks that's where Kant's metaphysics and the commitments of his morality come together. That's where they get acted out. So the postulates are the place in Kant's thought where he's thinking about the meaning of his own moral claims and what would be required for their consistency and their enactment. Begin there next week.